Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to begin by talking with my friend Rob Corzine of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. He's going to join us to unpack the themes of this weekend's readings. As is the case every week, Rob joins us to show us how all of the readings merge together in a common thread of speaking the covenant love of God. This week is no different. One of the sub-themes that comes out this week has to do with the call of God for all of us individually in our own lives and the response that that warrants. God is the one who makes the initiative, always. It is always God's choice to call us, not our own. We don't earn or merit the call of God. It's not according to our works. It's according to His own design. But that call is not unilateral to the effect that we have no say in the matter. Because God delights in making us participants in His work of redemption and salvation, because He honors us, because He values the gift of our freedom, He allows us to respond. And our yes actually means something. Our yes to God, our response to His vocation, actually does something to the world, to be sure, but also interiorly to us. The more we say yes to God, the more we allow His divine life into us. But we also have to understand that He then rewards us. He really does. He gives us merit. Every good thing that we do in Him is the crowning of the good that God does for us. But here's the thing. He crowns us for our good works, but it's only because He's crowning the good that He initiated and is doing in and through us simply because we are saying yes to Him. And yet, in the great mystery of this dual cooperation, non-competitive dual moral agency, God still makes us real participants, real causes. We're not predetermined. He actually lets us participate. So that's from the readings this weekend. We go on from there to speak with my friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen about our mutual friend passing. This is the death of Dr. Paul Thigpen. Matthew and I will remember his life and share his holiness. And then finally, I want to share with you about a rising trend in Hollywood and what that signals in terms of our society's hunger for true love. For now, the headlines.
Thank you, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Friday, February 27th. It's the Feast of St. Gregory of Narek, Doctor of the Church. Today's news brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Trump isn't pleased with how talks with Iran are going so far.
I'm not happy with the fact that they're not willing to give us what we have to have. So I'm not thrilled with that. We'll see what happens. We're talking later.
All non-essential personnel were asked to leave the U.S. Embassy in Israel as the president weighs a possible military strike on Iran, telling reporters today that he's not ruling it out. Pakistan says it's now in a state of open war with the Taliban government in neighboring Afghanistan after carrying out airstrikes against the two largest cities there. Hira Mustafa reporting that officials from both nations say Pakistan launched the strikes today, just hours after Afghan troops attacked Pakistani border positions.
What we are hearing from the officials is that Afghan Taliban initiated an unprovoked firing on Thursday, and because of that, Pakistan launched a military operation destroying more than 80 tanks, artillery, and personnel carriers.
Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, was hit, as well as the southern city of Kandahar, where the supreme leader of the Taliban is believed to be living. The U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom is urging the State Department to add Turkey to its special watch list due to the severe violations of religious freedoms. The recommendation follows moves by the European Parliament and the European Court of Human Rights in the past month to censure Turkey over its targeting of Christians. Stocks are ending the month sharply lower, stocks dropping in volatile trading after the producer price index showed a sharp rise in wholesale prices in January. Weakness in the tech and financial shares also leading worries about the economy, as all three major averages ended February in the red. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. Joining me as he does every week is my friend Rob Corzine of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. Rob, my friend, thank you very much for joining us this weekend. How are you?
I am doing great. We're only 11 days into Lent, so still feels easy. it's good to be here.
Well, as easy as it is, Holy Mother Church wants us to dive deeper this Sunday. So what does she have in store for us?
So it's really the theme of beginning the journey of faith, and we're starting to glimpse at a distance our final destination. On all 3 years of the lectionary, so A, B, and C, Second Sunday of Lent is always a key passage from the Abraham narrative, like Genesis 12 to 22, and then an account of the Transfiguration from one of the synoptic Gospels. So, in all the Gospels, the Transfiguration is this turn. It marks the beginning of the end of Jesus' earthly life. After the Transfiguration, Jesus is setting his face toward Jerusalem. He begins what John Bergsma calls the death march toward the holy city. And so the readings pair the beginning of Jesus' journey with to his death with the accounts of Abraham's life, because he's the paradigmatic figure of the Old Testament who goes on this journey of faith that culminates in the sacrifice of his only begotten son. So Jesus and Abraham are linked as men who journeyed in faith, and Lent for each of us is also a journey of faith toward greater holiness. So in the first reading, we have the opening of the Abraham narrative, where God calls Abram initially while he's still in his homeland in Ur of the Chaldees. We read, "The Lord said to Abram, go forth from the land of your kinsfolk and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you, and I will make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you and curse those who curse you. All the communities of the earth shall find blessing in you." Abram went as the Lord directed him. So in this way, Abram is called to begin this journey of faith that will eventually lead him from Chaldea to modern Iraq to Canaan, which is modern Israel. But note that God does not tell Abram where they're going. He is an elderly man at this point. He has a lot of property, but no children. And, the Lord comes to him and says, take everything that you've got that's movable, go from the land of your kinsfolk and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. He doesn't even tell them where they're going. Abram is this great forefather of faith. And, he's journeying to the promised land. Generations later, his descendants, the Israelites, are going to journey by faith again into the wilderness in the hopes of arriving at the same promised land, an event we call the Exodus. Generations later, still, the people of Judah will be forced to journey to Babylon, where they'll struggle to keep the faith for 70 years before being allowed to journey back to that same promised land. We're still in the beginning of Lent, and we continue to hear God's call on our lives to do the same, to begin a spiritual journey with him over these 40 days to a destination we don't know, but that God's going to show us. Dr. Hahn really unpacks this beautifully in a book he wrote many years ago called A Father Keeps His Promises, and it shows how here in this initial call of Abram, you have in the most compact form the outline for the next phases of salvation history. So, God promises that Abram, that you will become a great nation. That promise is fulfilled at Sinai when the multitudes of his descendants are formed into a nation, receiving, as it were, the constitution for a national polity, the Mosaic Covenant. Next, Abram's promised a great name an idea that's associated with royalty, and that finds fulfillment in the Davidic covenant that we read about in 2 Samuel 7, in which one of his descendants, David and his heirs, are established as kings over Israel, and actually, if you read really carefully, kings over the whole world. And then finally, God promises Abram that through him will come a universal blessing. Literally what it says, in you all the tribes of the earth, or all the families of the earth, will be blessed. And that looks forward to the new covenant, right? When Abram's descendant, Jesus, will come the conduit of divine blessing to all the Gentile families that, by the way, are listed just two chapters earlier in Genesis 10. People tend to think the Old Testament is a book about the salvation for the Jews, and that's not really right. The Old Testament always has been universal in scope. It's about the means of this blessing for all humanity, and the Abram, and whose name was changed to Abraham, and then his people, you know, they're chosen from amongst the nations, but to be the firstborn among the nations, to be a kingdom of priests, to guide all the nations to God. The promise of salvation has always been universal. Anytime any of us is chosen, it's always for the benefit of others. Every time you're blessed in order to be a blessing. So we move on to the psalm. We're on Psalm 33, where we read, "Upright is the word of the Lord, and all his works are trustworthy. He loves justice and right. Of the kindness of the Lord, the earth is full. See, the eyes of the Lord are upon those who fear him, upon those who hope for his kindness, to deliver them from death and preserve them in spite of famine. Our soul waits for the Lord, who is our help and our shield. May your kindness, O Lord, be upon us who have put our hope in you." These verses are meant to encourage us on our journey of faith, both the journey that's Lent and the larger faith journey of our lives. Lord, let your mercy be upon us as we place our trust in you. This is this word mercy here is this really pregnant word, hesed, that we find over and over again throughout the Psalter. It's often translated mercy or steadfast love, but its more technical meaning is covenant fidelity, the kind of unwavering love and faithfulness that covenant partners are to show towards one another. So in this psalm, we call on God to continue his covenant faithfulness to us, since through Jesus, the son of Abraham, we are heirs of covenantal promises that were given to Abraham so long ago. So that brings us to our second reading in 2 Timothy. Paul writing to his protege here, "Beloved, bear your share of hardship for the gospel with the strength that comes from God. He saved us and called us to a holy life, not according to our works, but according to his own design, and the grace bestowed on us in Christ Jesus before time began, but now made manifest through the appearance of our Savior Jesus Christ, who destroyed death and brought life and immortality to light through the gospel." So the second reading also encourages us to bear up under the hardships of our journey, whether those are external difficulties or the self-imposed mortifications of Lent. He begins this passage calling us to bear our share of hardship. And Lent should be a time of hardship to a certain extent. And the church leaves it up to us to exercise our discretion in terms of what mortifications to take on. You know, it's up to each of us, though, to challenge ourselves. It should be a real challenge. Giving up a few small treats around the edges that we hardly notice is really not sufficient. We need to set ourselves some goals that stretch us out of our comfort zone. My wife and I like to start Lent slow and add things as we go. But some of those should be physical deprivations, because part of the spirit of Lent is physical deprivation. It also helps if you're not doing anything that's really depriving you, then you're not doing something that you get to feast on during Easter. Like if you're giving up gossip, that's a good thing, but you're not going to feast by gossiping all during Easter. You want to give up things in your fast that you can then enjoy in your feast. We want to be in communion with Christ as he denied himself food for 40 days in the wilderness.
My guest is Rob Kozin of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, and Rob is walking us through the themes of this weekend's readings and what the Lord wants to speak to us through the wisdom of the church. Continuing on the other side, stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
This program brought to you in part by the following nonprofit research and educational institute.
This Lent, join Catholics across the country starting on Ash Wednesday, February 18th, for Bible Across America, a nationwide study on the practical relevance of the Bible for our daily lives, as we prepare to celebrate the resurrection of our Lord on Easter Sunday. Spearheaded by our sponsor, the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology, with some of today's leading Catholic voices. To learn more, visit stpaulcenter.com/ave.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA. Or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Rob Kozin of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. So Rob, you were just walking us through Lenten observances that help us deepen in the covenant love of the Father and holiness.
Yeah, I want to pick up one more idea from the second reading before we move on to the gospel. And it's this really kind of shocking statement by Paul. He saved us and called us to a holy life, not according to our works, but according to his own design and the grace bestowed on us in Christ Jesus before time began. We're living in this odd phase of church history where never before has the universal call to holiness been so clearly articulated in church documents and so widely neglected in actual practice. Now, before Vatican II and in ages earlier, there was this widespread notion, not that the church taught, but that there was sort of widely believed that true holiness was only attainable to priests and those in religious life. And the Vatican II removed that error by declaring that all the baptized faithful are called to the perfection of holiness and that everyone in the lay state could attain canonizable sanctity. But since then, the standards of prayer, mortification, morality, participation in the sacraments, pretty much any way you measure it, seem to have fallen precipitously and most especially in the most developed nations. But we shouldn't waste time bemoaning the idea that things were better in an early age. We need to remind ourselves that God has called us to a holy life. And we need to be both severe on ourselves, I think, in desiring a holy life, not just to sort of skate by. And we need to be merciful on ourselves and realize that, you know, Rome wasn't built in a day. And, you know, a holy life is not something you can just flip on a dime. And Lent is the time when we make progress. We have, you know, time set aside by the church to sort of lean in and push ourselves toward that goal that that God calls us to and through his Spirit empowers us to. So the gospel brings us to the Mount of Transfiguration. And the Matthew's account here, Matthew 17, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, Moses and Elijah appeared to them, conversing with him. Then Peter said to Jesus in reply, Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was still speaking, behold, a bright cloud cast a shadow over them. Then from the cloud came a voice that said, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell prostrate and were very much afraid. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, Rise and do not be afraid. And when the disciples raised their eyes, they saw no one else but Jesus alone. And they were coming down from the mountain, or rather, as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus charged them, Do not tell the vision to anyone until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. So as the fathers long recognized, the transfiguration is a foretaste or a glimpse of the glory of Christ in his resurrected state. And the sight of his glory is given to Peter, James, and John to encourage them to persevere through the difficult times that Jesus knows are coming as they're going to be witnesses to his passion as they wait for his resurrection. But for us now, hearing this gospel proclaimed at Mass, it's meant to encourage us to persevere, not only in Lenten mortification and asceticism until we sacramentally experience Christ's triumph at Easter, but even more broadly in embracing the sufferings of the Christian life until our lowly bodies become like his glorious body, as Paul says in Philippians. Now, it's long been recognized Moses and Elijah in this this episode are representative figures of the law, Moses, and the prophets, Elijah, the two main divisions of the Jewish canon of Scripture. So without questioning the literal historicity of the account, we can also see this iconic significance. Here are the law and the prophets, the Old Testament, the Old Covenant, conversing with Jesus, the New Testament. Peter's always eager to say or do something, not always the right thing, and he misunderstands the significance of the occasion, right? He jumps in, he sees Jesus as another prophet on par with the previous greats, and so he's like, let's build three tents, literally tabernacles, one for each. He has some understanding at this point of Jesus' identity, but he hasn't really grasped his uniqueness as the Son of God. Hebrews 1 puts this really starkly. In many and various ways, God spoke of old to our fathers by the prophets, but in these last days, he has spoken to us by a son. Moses and Elijah are great prophets, but they're in no way comparable to the one who's now been transfigured, who's now been manifest to the apostles. In a different gospel, one of the apostles who saw Christ transfigured emphasizes the uniqueness of Jesus. In the prologue to Gospel of John, right, the Word became flesh and tabernacled among us, full of grace and truth, and we have beheld his glory. As the account of the Transfiguration continues, the Father himself corrects Peter's well-meant but misguided equation of Christ and the prophets. So the cloud comes, and we hear the voice, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. The words of the Father from the crowd echo at least two pivotal passages from the Old Testament. First, Psalm 2, the royal coronation hymn, probably sung at the accession of each new son of David to the throne, proclaims the glory of the Davidic covenant. In verse 7, we read, I will tell of the decree of the Lord. He said to me, You are my son. Today I have begotten you. So the words of the Father here remind us of Jesus' Davidic kingship. He's the royal heir who, like the sons of David of old, is also given the privilege of being a son of God. But he surpasses the previous sons of David because he's son of God, not just by covenant, but by nature. Secondly, that phrase, beloved son, the Father calls to mind the image of Isaac in Genesis 22, who's referred three times in that passage as Abraham's Ben Yahid, his one and only son. Take your son, your only son whom you love. And the Septuagint gives us that as huios agapatos, your beloved son. But this is, you know, your only beloved son, the phrase we hear over and over again in the Gospel of John. And this turn of phrase reminds us that Jesus is the new Isaac, like Isaac in Genesis 22, who will carry the wood of his sacrifice up the mountain to offer his life to God in obedience to the Father. So the Mount of Transfiguration looks forward to Calvary. The uniqueness of Jesus as mediator between Father and humanity is emphasized one last time by the fact that rising from prostration, the disciples now see no one else but Jesus alone. The one and only Son is the only mediator who's ultimately necessary. Transfiguration also links to the theme that we had in the first reading of the journey. Although you have to borrow a bit, I think, from Luke's account to see it super clearly. You know, Luke 9:31 specifies that Moses and Elijah were discussing with Jesus his upcoming departure, literally his exodus in Jerusalem. And the very next day, Jesus tells his disciples of his upcoming passion. And shortly after, we read he sets his face toward Jerusalem and begins that final earthly journey. So in Luke, that 10 to 19 is roughly known as the travel narrative, because he's going from Galilee down to Jerusalem to make his exodus. So for the remainder of Lent, you know, we need to spiritually accompany Jesus on this final journey. We are headed, you know, we know towards the resurrection, but first, you know, we're headed toward Good Friday, toward the suffering, the humiliation, and the death that ultimately lead to that glory. So we should encourage ourselves this week with the thought that Jesus transfigured is an image of the glory of holiness that awaits us at the end of Lent, at the end of life's journey, provided we willingly embrace the hardships that are necessary for holiness. So let's, as we've been saying, let's go live Lent.
Way to package the joy with the sorrow together. Thank you so much, Rob. And Rob's right. Embrace the cross and the suffering that we may enter into the glory of the Lord. Let's live Lent. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
He was a mystic and reformer who died at the age of 33.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Catherine of Siena accomplished something no one thought possible. She convinced Pope Gregory XI to return to Rome after the popes had lived in France for almost the whole of the 14th century. They've been there ever since.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
How did the apostles learn to pray? By observing their leader, the master of prayer, Jesus Christ. The Catholic Catechism reminds us that Jesus often drew apart, frequently at night on a mountaintop, to pray in solitude. He includes everyone in his prayer, for he has taken on humanity in his incarnation, and he offers us all to the Father when he offers himself. By his human prayer, The Word, who has become flesh, shares in all that his brethren experience. He sympathizes with our weakness in order to free us. Thanksgiving precedes Jesus' prayer as in raising of Lazarus from the dead. Before the miracle, Jesus prays, "Father, I thank you for having heard me," which implies that the Father always hears his petitions. Jesus also reveals how to ask. Say thank you before the gift is given. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Dr. Ray Guarendi.
What's the definition of frustration? Frustration is the difference between the way it is and the way you want it to be. It's hard to change the way it is. The way it is sometimes is other people, life, circumstances. The way you want it to be is in your power to change. You can close the gap between reality and what you want. The smaller that gap, the less your frustration. It is always easier to change oneself than to change reality. Frustration isn't always what happens out there. It is how we look at what happens out there.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. It's no surprise to many people listening to this program that the great giant of the Catholic faith, especially here in the U.S., Paul Thigpen, passed at the age of 71. My friend Dr. Matthew Bunsen and I had touched base about it on Thursday, but we wanted to speak a little more in depth about it because we both knew him personally. Matthew, thank you very much for making the time to talk with me again. How are you?
Very good to be with you. I wish, as we are forced to say, wish it were under better circumstances, but an opportunity to speak about a remarkable person like Paul Thigpen is much appreciated, and it's a privilege for me to be here.
Remarkable is the word. And when I introduced the reality that he had passed in the news, I shared that it was a bittersweet piece of news, because knowing him, knowing how prayerful he was, I have a lot of hope that he is journeying towards the beatific vision with our Lord. And I'd like to begin with asking you to share about who he was, the way he lived his life, just the general overarching view.
Well, I think one of the best places to start is actually from the CEO of Tan Books, because Paul wrote, I think, about 60 some books, many of them with Tan Publishers, and their CEO, Connor Gallagher, had a statement on X a couple of days ago when the news broke about Paul's death. And he finishes it by saying, "I have no doubt that Paul's work has not ended but only begun. From heaven, he will do even more for those he loved than he could while on earth. There is so much more to say about the man that I only wish I could capture here." That's a lovely sentiment, because I think it's something that all of us would agree with, that he left a very significant body of writings. He made many contributions to publications, to academic work. But I think the thing that almost anyone who had any encounters with him, certainly who had the privilege of getting to know him as a friend, was that this was a truly good person. And that having those encounters with him, just those conversations, I think a few people have made the observation that any conversation that you had with him, you tended to leave those not just in a good mood, not just edified, but also a genuinely better and better informed person.
I can second all of that. And maybe before we talk about his deep heart of the Lord, let's talk about his gargantuan intellect.
Yeah, I mean, this is someone who was born in Savannah, Georgia, eventually converted, and I will talk about that because that is a very intense experience for him, certainly. But then he went on, once he found religion, once he found faith, to study for a BA in religious studies from Yale. He also, and of course, graduated summa cum laude, earned an MA and then a doctorate in historical theology at Emory University in Atlanta. That the key there is historical theology, because this is somebody who had a wide breadth of knowledge about the Catholic faith. You know, some of us are specialists. Some of us really have areas that we love to talk about or to research. Paul knew a little bit or a lot about a lot. And that, I think, was crucial to his work, crucial to just the dazzling variety of work. I mean, he went from talking about a dictionary of quotes from saints to a book on extraterrestrial intelligence in the Catholic faith, to a book on saints who battled Satan. Of course, he had the very famous thing, the Manual of Spiritual Warfare. So this demonstrates a little bit of, sometimes there's an overused phrase of, he was a Renaissance man or a Renaissance person. Paul really was. And I can also speak personally to the fact that he was a fantastically good cook. He fixed for some of us during a visit that he made in Indiana, in Fort Wayne. He fixed a very traditional Southern meal. And I think it's as close as I've come to dropping dead from a meal, just because it was so rich, but it was also so delicious. And that also spoke volumes about Paul, because he had this great sense of humor. But he also had all these other talents that made spending time with him so enjoyable.
And as a Renaissance man, you would be able to speak to that well. I know you. I'm still laughing at that comment. But really, I think even what you describes the man as brilliant as he was. He was a man of immense richness interiorly, and that therefore communicates to us not just his amazing plethora of skills, but his heart for the Lord. And I invite you to speak to that.
Yeah, I think that love of God, that love of Christ, that love of the church imbued everything that he did. And he is and should be remembered as one of those unsung but great converts of the last of the second half of the 20th century. He found Christ, but this is also somebody who had a harrowing, dark journey getting there. You know, he talks about that great line that he believed in the devil, he realized, before he believed in God. And he had those dabblings, those encounters with the occult. And his story reminds me very much of someone like Bartolo Longo, mm-hmm. Saint Bartolo Longo, who at one point was himself in Italy, in a very difficult time, a priest of the satanic worship, and then found himself, as one does who dabbles in the occult, in a very, very dark and terrible place. Paul's journey was similar, and he found his way out of the darkness and into the light. And then that exploration of what he was called to believe, to be and to believe. And so he comes back to Christianity at the age of 18. And he decided that at that point he needed to know more about religion, and went on at a certain point to be an associate pastor of a charismatic congregation and wrote for Christian publications. But he was never satisfied with that. He would move, as so many do, from one Protestant church to the next. He talked about the fact that at one point he was a Presbyterian. He looked at the Baptists. He considered the Methodists, the Episcopalians. All of them, he said, taught him very important lessons about walking with God. But he, as he wrote, sooner or later, he had to admit that none of them was home. And that's why he joined the church with his wife, daughter, and son in 1993. And you can tell that he never looked back. That journey to the Catholic faith was so liberating for him intellectually, spiritually, that I think that was one of the keys to his immense ability to be such a prolific writer, but not just a fast writer, not just a prolific writer, as I was saying, but a really good one. Mm. And to, again, to have that variety of topics and interests on his part.
Matthew, you and I can keep plumbing the depths of his great contributions to the church, but as a as a kind of final word for all of our listeners about not just Paul's contribution and the fact that you and I knew him personally, but that he never let any of that go to his head because he saw himself as a child and servant of the Lord.
That's exactly right. I was going to say that as a final observation about Paul was, I've said it before, his sense of humor, but also his humility. He understood his own history of how he entered the church, how he came to know God. And if I had to have a word that was permeating so much of how he articulated his faith, it was gratitude. It was this gratitude on his part for having made that journey and for having discovered the beauty of the Catholic faith, and then to have that privilege, which he did and talked about that, of exploring so many dimensions of the Catholic faith. Because as you and I have talked, it is an endless journey of exploring the Catholic faith, of deepening our own knowledge of the faith. And the more you study, the more you realize there's so much more to know. And Paul right now, I think, knows a lot more than we do.
He truly does. Every question. Is it all right to have a holy envy of him? My guest has been...
Just gratitude.
My guest has been Dr. Matthew Bunsen, Vice President, Editorial Director of EWTN News. We've been talking about the passing of our mutual friend, Dr. Paul Thigpen, and the hope of his joy in the beatific vision.
Hello, friends. Deacon Harold Burke-Sivers here. And I haven't been this excited about an up-and-coming speaker for a long time, Dr. Marcus Peter. Dr. Peter has the gift of combining deep theological insight, wisdom, and knowledge with personal testimony and story in a way that makes the power of the church's teaching and God's love felt deeply in the heart of all who hear him. If you are looking for someone for your next conference, parish mission, or event, look no further than Dr. Marcus Peter.
Visit MarcusBPeter.com to book Dr. Marcus Peter to speak at your event. At the Ave Maria website, you can continue the discussion and education through the Ave Maria Radio's links to social media. Ave Maria Radio has accounts on Facebook, X, TikTok, YouTube, and Instagram. Go to AveMariaRadio.net and find the social media symbols at the top of your screen.
Stephen Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Pope Francis said, "The key that opens the door to faith is prayer." Join St. Paul Street Evangelization by running a prayer station in the public square. You don't need to be a professional apologist or theologian. Just listen to the needs of the people you encounter. Offer encouragement, take prayer requests, and pray with people. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, like more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
You've probably heard Venerable Father Patrick Peyton say, "The family that prays together stays together." Well, as the director of the Peyton Institute, I like to add that the family that plays together also prays together. Family play rituals, like family days, game nights, and other similar activities, aren't just fun things to do. They're ways Catholic families remind each other to celebrate the life God has given them. Daily play rituals remind families that both in good times and in hard times, God always wants us to look for reasons to rejoice. That's one reason family rituals for playing together are such an important part of Catholic family life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I came across a commentary that Hollywood is renewing an interest in making more adaptations for romance novels and romance stories. The market apparently is demanding it. And so I really wanted to comment on it. Hollywood's current obsession with translating these best-selling romance fiction novels into film and streaming content, I think, is an indicator of a deep cultural desire. For a long time now, we've seen how love has been completely reduced to nothing but emotions. Hollywood studios are desperate for dependable audiences and profitable tentpoles. They've made every experimentation in the book, and everything has exploded in their faces. So now they're going back to a formula that's bankable because it's tried and true. These novels that clamor for intimacy, passion, emotional fulfillment. News outlets, of course, are cheering this. You know, it's a renaissance of love stories. Entertainment is going to show love once again, as if this is a business calculation that's wrapped in flowers. The problem is that this kind of romantic adaptation surge is going to signal, at the end of the day, a continued banal, secular, and shallow depiction that's devoid of the genuine frameworks for things like what real love is, and commitment, and marital fidelity. Here's the problem. Our culture, this has happened before. Our culture now is going through this surge once again in terms of its art. The ascendancy of these romance adaptations and the content pipelines, all of these are a paradox. Because on the surface, the entertainment industry is trumpeting aesthetic escapism. And it's delivering to us, you know, these curated fantasies of continued seduction without commitment. But you scrape that veneer, and it's a thin veneer at best. Producers and writers are sensing that millions of consumers are interiorly exhausted because alienation, a dystopic mindset, chaotic multiplicity, all of these things have left people raw and hollow. And so readers of romance novels are, if they are avid readers, they've long celebrated a perpetuation of these narratives that last in the long lasting, because they speak to the interior hopes of all human persons as lovers, the private inclination towards things like trust, fidelity, affection, enduring attachment. So yes, these great fictional novels reflect a human impulse that God made us for commitment, for a shared life. And that's infinitely more meaningful than these baseless flings that Hollywood has been throwing at us for decades now. Hollywood's renewed romance focus can be interpreted as a welcome diversification of genres, sure. But we all know that if we were to take a good look at it, we can understand that corporations are only looking at the bottom line. What's really lacking in the culture and what's signaling the demand is the hunger for interpersonal connection and, frankly, a passionate love that is actually willing the good of the other over the self. Audiences apparently, according to analysts, have been gravitating away from blockbuster spectacles. There's fatigue over franchises. The superhero genre is probably milked out by now. But these themes of courtship, of virtue, of chivalry, of chemistry, and you know what? Sure, to some degree, even the emotional rhythm of coupling, all of those things speak to a perennial yearning that once the spectacle is stripped away, actually connects with the deepest desires of the human person. But when you have an entire entertainment industry that's bombarded us with relentless, hyperactive visual language, like I mentioned, the superhero epics or gruesome speculative universes, well, it's no wonder that people are begging for an interior reprieve. And so the industry commentators are asserting that, yeah, sure, we'll go down this path. The emotional narratives at the heart of these adaptations are going to provide a counterweight, and so we'll sell well. But my hope is that perhaps this might signal a reversal of the industry towards those things that we take for granted. That hopefully Hollywood's notion of romance will move from the transactional into the transcendental, from the superficial to perhaps, if it's not too much to ask, the supernatural. In other words, I'm hoping that a return to classical modes of the pursuit of man and woman as a reflection of a perennial love, my hope is that that can save the entertainment industry by reinstilling a sense of a moral compass. Because it really is remarkable upon reflection that the very generation that is demanding more and more romance adaptations is the same generation that's failed to sustain stable marriages at scale. And I'm talking about at historical scale. Demographic analysts report decline in marriage rates, delays in lifelong partnering. In fact, the studies, we've all known this to be true, but the studies have proven that cohabitating partners simply delay concepts of engagement and marriage and sometimes never even get to that point because the back door is always open. You enter the relationship with the notion of it ending in mind. And so what does that cause? Well, it doesn't solve the problem. It results in increases in serial cohabitation without a sense of lasting commitment for generations now. Marriage was the bedrock institution of our natural society, especially here in the United States. It was an institution undergirded by a plethora of community structures. We had shared rituals, and of course, it is defined by real economic cooperation and social accountability. Yes, your neighbors, your family, they held you to account to be a good spouse. Failing to be that would earn you the social title of scoundrel. But today, those anchors have eroded, if they exist at all. Families are fracturing early and often. It's heartbreaking that my bride and I, we journey with a lot of young couples who prepare for marriage, and we've already known a handful, most who did not journey with us, actually. We've already known a handful of our peers who have entered into marriages and seen them end within 1 to 5 years. We've also seen, and the studies are proving this, individualistic self-fulfillment becoming a marker of how the marriage conducts itself. And it eclipses what God plans for marriage and the family, covenanted permanence. If you have that as the sociological context, individualistic self-fulfillment, well then, Hollywood's recycling of romantic novels is not going to be a celebration of real love. It's going to be a period of cultural sedation only to return to bombarding us with hyperactive stimulation all over again. But I believe this is an indicator that as a culture, we are thin within and we are longing for depth. So audiences today are steeped in concepts of emotional volatility. And what do we have as a result? Unmet relational yearnings. And yes, we crave good fiction. We crave good stories that, at least at the vicarious level, can supply for us a concept of connection and closure. Good books can do that. So as Hollywood's producers respond with these glossy adaptations that show us courtship and desire, my hope is that they also root them in durable, perpetuated commitments. Because that's what the heart longs for. We want that kind of a resolution. If we don't, then all you're going to get is a kind of spiritual mirage. It's going to be a simulacrum of relational flourishing, but when it doesn't have the soil of community and perpetuated commitment and sacrificial love, well, then all that's being offered is an idealized veneer that when you scrape is hollow and empty, and people will leave hungrier than before. Because the problem is most of these adaptations, if left to the minds of present-day Hollywood producers, they rely on formulaic beats. A protagonist stumbles upon serendipitous encounters, meet-cutes they call them. They accumulate a series of misunderstandings that results into your typical rom-com. The dramatic stakes are heightened, and then there's passionate embrace. But then what? Well, as quickly as they got with each other, they implode. That's why that genre cannot last. But really, as I mentioned, it indicates a broader cultural shift. all the institutions that once mediated love. Family, society, church, neighborhood, educational communities, all of these, they simply don't exist anymore. Or if they do, they don't have the same influence. And in their absence, we as individuals now must fill that gap. We quite literally cannot depend on those structures to help us have strong marriages and strong families. We have to rise up within our families. Parents have to rise up. And we have to build for ourselves neighborhoods that are not confined by geographic region. We have to build for ourselves those Catholic communities that share a covenantal worldview. Because if we don't, all we are doing is entering into that same aestheticized romance that's devoid of the real work of labor and virtue that results in the real happiness that we're made for, which is the possession of the perfect good in Christ in our marriage and family, which is really my personal daily prayer. Our secular society, by means of what these analysts are showing, they're hungry for real love, not just surface level romance. And so if any Hollywood producer or story writer is listening to this right now, please take this as an exhortation. Rather than giving us these pursue narratives that are all about desire and culminating in explosive consummation but no commitment, rather than giving us that, give us the kind of love that sacrifices, the kind of love that fights to survive, the kind of love that wills the good of the other over the self, the kind of love that wakes up every day and chooses the other, the kind of love that isn't about me and myself and my expressive individualism, but instead, it's the kind that will last. Because I trust that the other is doing the same for me. Give us the kind of durable love that Christ talks about in his scriptures, that the entirety of the scriptures have told us about, that the theology of the body speaks of. Give us the kind of love that's grounded in commitment and vows before God and man. Give us the kind of love that is not just about compensating for what's lacking in the world. Give us the kind of love that screams covenant. I can almost guarantee you, if all of our entertainment were to do that, quoting Father Donald Keefe, if all Catholics lived out the grace of the sacrament of matrimony, in one generation, the entire world would be completely transformed. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.